This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. I have the air blowing because it's a little warm today. I would like to tell you that I actually have the air conditioning blowing, but I actually need to charge up my little air conditioner, and I haven't done that. So I just have air blowing, and it's not bad. It's, you know, it's okay. It's all right. And it's nice to be warm again. All through the winter, I look forward to being warm again. And I am warm again. And we are not even finally there. It's really not that bad outside at all. There's a cool breeze today. I was just going to check my phone and see what the temperature was. Temperature, 81 degrees. That's nothing. Pretty soon here, it'll be up in the 90s. Inside the closed up car, it'll be even hotter. So it's been a good week. It is Friday today, instead of Thursday. You know, my brain goes on autopilot when I start these podcasts, because I've said the same thing so often. I don't think I said it was Thursday, but I might have already forgotten that. It's actually Friday today. I forgot my recorder at home yesterday. I had breakfast with a buddy. Turns out a buddy and his son, so that was fun. And so I got scurrying out of the house a little ahead of myself, and I didn't pick up my recorder. But as it turns out, I have to come in, do grocery shopping with my dad anyways, and so did that. Today it was for my dad. I'll get to that in a minute. Did that, and then realized I had left a couple of big books in at my major client, and so I needed to actually go back in and get those anyways, because I'm going to need them for a little presentation tomorrow. We are in the week now of doing presentations on the new website that we put up, and people seem to be happy with it so far. Yay. The Global Leadership Summit is going to be tomorrow, and there's about 130 leaders from all over the world. The different various sections of the world are going to be in. They're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff. And so the head of the division that I'm working with asked me if I'd come in and do like a 15-minute overview of the whole project that we're working on with the finances and what the plans are and what's coming next and blah, 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 blah. So I have to run down south tomorrow to do that presentation, but as part of that presentation, I'm actually going to quickly recap a job that I did for this same client about 5 years ago that really was the springboard to the project that I'm working on now. And that produced a couple of big, thick books of business processes outlines. And so I wanted to have those for show and tell, because I do show and tell tomorrow. Everything seems to be going well there. Just go in every day, try to give them good value for their money, and work through the problems, and get things working, and move on to the next thing. So, a week from Monday, I've got a little 5-minute presentation that I'm going to be doing, for a larger crowd. Once those two are done, then I can really get back to focusing on the next step in all of this. But so far, so good. We got all our deployments done. We got, you know, all the special things done that we were wanting to do with it. And, it's on to the next project. So that's good. That's good. And, you know, I'm blessed. I'm just blessed. It's good work. It's work that is enjoyable. It's challenging. And I seem to have the skill sets to be able to pull it off, and so praise God for that. And then I get to go home and write, and that's even better. I am finishing up my job this week. This last week was to complete the edits, do a read-through, complete the edits. I was able to cut out about 25 pages, not all full pages, some half pages, but I was able to cut out about 25 pages and about 8,000 words, almost 9,000 words out of the manuscript. just by killing some of the recaps and internal dialogue stuff that was just slowing things down, and really it was not necessary. So that's good, and you know, I really appreciate the beta readers going, "You've already said this." Oh, right, sorry, let me pull that out. So, because then that kind of said, yeah, you really need to kind of stop that and fix this and fix that. And so I just went through and ripped a bunch of that stuff down. So now I'm finishing up on the cover. That's actually my job today, is to get finished up on the cover stuff and get the files uploaded so I can get a proof copy ordered and get that over, not overnighted, but get it sent in maybe second day air so I can get it in as quickly as possible. And then tomorrow, my job tomorrow, even though I have that presentation, I'll work on it in the morning, is to get the Kindle version up and the EPUB version up. And I used to do a version for Apple as well, but I have just given up on the iBooks. It's just, it's, you know, it's one thing when you're not selling any books if it's easy to publish your books electronically. But Apple makes you jump through so many hoops, and they take so long to approve everything, that, you know what, it's just, it, as long as you're not selling them anyways, why put yourself through that stuff? I mean, with Kindle, you, well, with Nook, you upload the stuff, and you say go, and they say, great, you're published, you know. And with Kindle, you upload all the stuff, and they go, great, you'll be published in 12 hours or 24 hours. First of all, with Apple, you have to get your own ISBN, so you have to buy your own ISBN for it. Then you have to upload it only through their interface, which means you have to use an iMac or some kind of Macintosh computer, because it's an application that they've built just to run on their Macintosh computer. So the only way you can upload stuff to them is through their computers, which is just goofy in this day and age. And then, even after you jump through all those hoops and you say, well, there it is, they go, great, we'll get back with you. And it'll be like 2 to 3 weeks before it will be up. It's like, oh, you know what? I don't think so. So at least I don't have to do that one anymore. But if I can get that all done, I'll be really, really, really close to schedule then, because I wanted to have this stuff all wrapped up by June the 15th. And June the 15th will be Monday. Won't quite be there, but I'll be really, really, really close. I will be close. And then I can get back to Windfall, the Narrow Door. Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, so that's that. In exciting news with the family, my beloved father went head over heels down a set of brick stairs last Saturday. He had gone up the stairs just fine, and he was leaving a party for his great-granddaughter, my granddaughter Clara, and he decided he was going to go down the stairs without using the handrail, and he lost his footing, and it's a miracle he didn't break something. I mean, I just don't understand how he didn't break something. He just fell right or something. Banged up his knee a little bit, scraped it up, really scraped up his arm, grazed his head, but there was no concussion or anything like that. And he's healing up. He's still sore, but he's healing up. And it's amazing. It's just amazing. He was, you know, I mean, he's at that age now where he's 92. It was funny because he went to the doctor, and the doctor wanted to put him on this blood pressure medicine, this other kind of blood pressure medicine. And my dad said, well, I don't really want to take that. And the doctor said, well, you know, you don't have to take it if you don't want to. You're 92. You're going to die soon anyways. Good job, doc. That's good. That's really good. So, anyways, that's the news from like, well, we got. This year, if you've been listening to these podcasts at all, you know that this year, past year, really has been a year when I think I have learned more. Maybe I haven't shared this on the podcast. Yeah, I think I have. I think I have learned more about the average, in general, woman's psyche than I have known my entire life. I was out with a buddy several weeks ago, and I told him, I said, you know, I think I can safely say that I understand how women think. And he looked at me and he went, really? Or something to that effect. I said, yeah, I do. I understand how women think. And so I got to sharing with him. He wasn't sure he was ready to buy into all of it yet. That's okay. Part of the reason I go out with people and talk to them and share with them is because I want to bounce ideas off them, see their reactions, hear their feedback. You know, I want to hear that. But, you know, he was listening, and he was kind of telling me about some of his situation, and frankly, in my mind at least, what he's expressing confusion about in his relationship to his wife is perfectly explained by the framework that I have been working on for women for the last year. It's perfectly explained. And I should say right from the beginning, none of this is to point fingers and accuse. What this is to understand, to try to understand, and out of that understanding to offer grace and mercy and to be grateful. You know, you wouldn't make demands on people whom you know are not capable of those demands, and yet a lot of times, we as men think everybody thinks the way we do, top down, deep. And when we think that way, then when we encounter something different from a cultural or from a gender standpoint, we think, well, the only reason they're not doing that is because they don't want to. And they're rejecting me, when in fact there are deeper things that are going on. And it's very, very difficult for a person to be able to, who is not a guy, for a woman to be able to have the same types of approaches to things. In general, on average, I keep having to say that, but everything I say is in general, on average. And it's ridiculous for us to keep rehashing the same territory over and over and over and over and over again when it hasn't changed in thousands of years, and it's not going to change in thousands of years, because men and women approach things completely differently. And in that vein, I came across an article by a Melissa Petro. And the name of the article was Intimacy After the Call Girl Years: How Sex Work Changed the Way I Have Sex. And I'll grant you, she is not on average and in general, because not all women engage in sex work and call girl activities. However, I think there are themes here that resonate with all women in general, on average. And it is those themes that were particularly interesting to me, because they fit very easily within the whole idea that men are primarily driven by lust and women are primarily driven by fear. That results then in what I used to say, that when it comes to marriage, men trade security for sex and women trade sex for security. Except it doesn't work out that way. But that's what the initial premise oftentimes is. However, in this process of looking at how this woman's experience overtly as a sex worker then influence her intimacy in her marriage, I think is very insightful. Because she starts off by saying that by playing the part of a sexual object, it actually gave her of a feeling of control. She said because she started out working as a stripper, and then she started advertising herself on Craigslist as a non-pro and what amounted to the girlfriend experience. Apparently, this is a thing. And so what they would do is they would get together as if it was a first date, you know, and they would have a few drinks and talk, and she would giggle and laugh at his jokes, and then they would go back, and then they would end up having sex. But it was more like a girlfriend as opposed to just an overt sex worker. And that process, she says, gave her a feeling of control. Because she said often she was much more experienced than the people she was going out with. And then she could kind of control the situation. The guy would kind of comply. And she said, I felt in charge and control. And she said, at the time, it felt empowering. So that's one little piece. And that's an interesting little piece. She does say that to believe that all sex workers have been victimized invalidates the experiences of those who have been, but to believe that the sex industry doesn't have an effect on the private lives and identities of its workers is equally naive. And she said, for her, sex blurred the lines between authenticity and performance. And she quotes a writer and psychologist who theorizes, and this was a very interesting quote. The name of the author and psychologist is Carrie Cohen, who theorizes that for women, sex is performance, intimacy or trauma, that it's all performance. Okay, well, the question is why would it be performance? Why doesn't it feel like it feels like for a guy? It's performance because it's driven by fear. Because it is a means to an end. It's not the end. You know, for a guy, sex is kind of the end. Once we get to it, then you move on to the next thing. And we're done. But in general, on average, I'm coming to understand more and more, I think, that, hey, my son-in-law is out driving kiddo around here. We gotta stay and say hello. So how's it going, buddy? Hello! How are you?
It looks like you may be doing your driving home.
I'm doing the driving home podcast. Say hi! Hi! That's Clara. That's Clara. They're just going for a little ride today. Okay, so we're doing the thing at your house tomorrow? The staff thingy?
Yes.
Yes. Are you wanting to take pictures?
Yes, but we've got some.
Okay, cool. I am relieved. See ya. Okay, so, that's like a really, really important thing. Sex is performance. And while in the case of a sex worker, this is exacerbated to a higher degree, I'm really wondering now if it does not hold a nugget of truth all the way down the line. But let's go ahead and finish up. I'm checking the mail. I don't know if it will be here yet. No, it's not, because it's only 11:42, because I'm just coming back from doing grocery shopping for Dad. So, anyways, so she goes back and she starts recapping. She said, when I got out of prostitution, I began to recognize the ways that working in the industry had affected me. She said, for starters, I began to see how I'd been conditioned to enjoy the role I played when I sold sex. She said, at 19 years old, I felt like I'd found the job I'd been training for my whole life. Sex was a source of power even before it was a source of capital. One moment. I'm backing into my garage. She says, in both paid and unpaid encounters, I used my sexuality. I'm running out of notes. One moment. Backing into the garage. Okay, here we go. She said, in paid and unpaid encounters, I used my sexuality to feel desirable as a means of security and validation and as a way to feel love. So she gets out of the work. She meets a guy. And immediately, things are very intense with this guy. Very, very intense. This is someone who has used sex for power, successfully, and for money. She said, he had a sexual appetite that resembled my own, one that I've rarely felt matched by my partners. We spent the rest of that weekend together, mostly in bed, coming up only for air when it was time for a meal or to walk the dogs. He was fun, and fun is, well, fun. But I wasn't only interested in a one-night stand. She said, I wouldn't say that the sex we had on the first night was intimate. Instead, it felt intimate walking home from dinner with a candid conversation about my sexual history. Vulnerable was how I felt before we had sex, being let into his space, seeing his things and belongings. She said, before Aaron, sex had never been an intimate act. Instead, I used sex as a way of domineering, hedging off fear, and keeping someone at arm's length. They say that intimacy is the product of being vulnerable, but I don't feel vulnerable when I have sex. Okay. Instead, I feel vulnerable in the awkward minutes afterwards. The awkwardness I've learned to resolve by, well, having more sex. So she says that then we kept together and intimate, and we became more intimate. Okay. Wasn't a stranger anymore. Someone I like, wanted him to like me, someone whose opinion I valued. What's interesting is even though she supposedly had this voracious sexual appetite, that once she actually became more emotionally involved with him, it began to be harder to be vulnerable with him. And she said, you know, we'd be having sex and he wants to make sure I'm enjoying myself and he wants to make sure everything's okay. And if it's not, he stops, blah, 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 blah. And she said, initially, what felt like Aaron's insistence that I enjoy myself reminded me of being with a client and the pressure to put on a good show, which is an interesting turn. Because he cares about her and he's interested in her needs, there's something inside her that's digging in now and pushing back. And even now, his attention makes me self-conscious. The fact that he's not just looking at me for his own sexual gratification feels different. Other times it's uncomfortable. I'm learning to deal with that discomfort. If I want intimacy, I have to tolerate being seen. She said, sometimes I don't want to be intimate. Sometimes I want to listen to the Moth podcast or watch whatever on HBO, even though I've seen that episode 3 times. I want to catch up on work. I want to shop online for curtains or eat ice cream from the carton. I don't want to have sex. I want to be alone, as I've grown accustomed to being. Sure, it's normal to want space, but I like a lot of it. And she says, well, for someone with a history like mine, I'm coming to realize even reasonable bids for my attention can feel overly demanding. So, that's Alan going by with my grandson. So she said, getting in the mood was never something I'd required when I'd have sex for money or a whim. At first, I was ambivalent about having sex for free when I didn't necessarily desire it. But a healthy sex life, I'm learning, requires effort. Though I'd never consider myself a selfish lover, I had to confront my what's in it for me attitude that came from having previously been compensated for my company. And she attributes this to the fact that sex workers learn strategies of distancing and disentanglement and disassociation and disembodiment. But I'm really wondering. She said, this is, I should read this. This is according to researchers like Wendy Chappas and Tila Sanders and interpreted by the sex workers' rights movement as a defense that sex work is non-affecting. Problem is, you can't turn off embodiment like a switch. You can only shut down, and when you habitually disengage and disassociate, you narrow your range of emotional experiences. Working in the sex industry, I shut down, I went numb, I lost my ability to empathize. Returning and remaining present in my body nearly a decade later remains a daily practice. She said, when I stopped having sex for money, I suffered from the fallacy that sex for free should never feel like work. What I've learned is that sometimes it does. It can also feel different. It can feel like love. Okay, so that's very, very interesting to me. And the reason it's very, very interesting to me is I think there's more going on there than just a sex worker case. I certainly think it's exaggerated in a sex worker case, but I'm coming to believe more and more that women in general and on average have a dissonant relationship with physical intimacy. That as they are coming up through their teenage years and they begin to experience that power of being sexually attractive and having men look at them and want them and that sort of thing, and they start playing with that, and that gives them a feeling of empowerment and a feeling of control. And as they use those techniques to woo a guy, because I have had many conversations with husbands who will tell me that the woman that they knew when they were dating is not the woman that they're married to. That there was a playfulness and an openness and a vulnerability and an attractiveness just in banter and the way they conduct themselves that disappears after marriage. And you could lay that all on the fault of the men. You could. And certainly the men would have some things in all of that that would... Hello! Clara, that was Clara again. Certainly you could lay some of that blame on the men. You could, absolutely. But I think there's another mechanic that's going on here, and that is that at work, as women are moving through those teenage years and those early adult years where men are attracted to them and men are wanting something from them, and sometimes they comply because they're lonely and they want safety and they want the feeling of being validated and being loved. I think that whole process, even in women who don't have sex before marriage, I think that whole process of using their physical attractiveness to gain attention from men does the same thing in a smaller way to women who are not in the sex work as it does to women who are involved in sex work. And there is that whole list of D's, disembodiment, disempower, detachment, where was it? One moment. Yeah, this whole idea of distancing, disengagement, disassociation, and disembodiment. I think that happens in women as well. And so everything is performance. It is a performance when you're trying to find someone to marry. And after you've found someone to marry, then to continue that performance seems disingenuous at a base level. And so, in fact, there's some drift away from that. And I won't tell you that I've got all the pieces in, but I think it's a really fascinating thing. And I think, in general, on average, physical intimacy is kind of a double-edged sword for women. And I've actually talked to some women who, when I've made that statement, they've nodded and they'd say, yeah, it is. because in one sense, they feel obligated. Some feel obligated since they have begun down a path with their husband and they know their husband has certain expectations and certain needs, we'll say, although he should be able to meet those needs himself, that they feel a certain obligation to do it. But they're exactly like the woman in this article is, where it's like, I want to listen to the Moth podcast, or I want to just watch reruns on HBO. That's why I said months and months ago, the fact of the matter is that Beyonce, when she goes home, for all the image that she portrays, for the performance that she puts out there, when she goes home, she's not going to dress up in all those corsets and high heels and stockings and all that kind of stuff just so she can woo and excite her husband. She's going to put on a pair of sweats and she wants to play with her baby. It's just like Jessica Alba, who had this big stripper pole scene in Sin City, A Dame to Die For, that she practiced on for months, writhing around. And I haven't seen it, but I'm sure she does a spectacular job of it. That when someone asks her, so do you dress at home like this for her husband? And she goes, oh, no, you know, I just put on some sweats. That's when I feel comfortable. But this leads to a lot of confusion in men because they're like, what? You know, and I'm sure her husband, what he probably was smart enough not to say it, but I'm sure her husband is like, well, so you'll dress up that way because someone pays you to, and you'll do all that dancing for millions of men who sit in front of you in the theater because they'll pay some money, but when you come home, you won't do that for me. And who knows what Jessica Alba does for her husband. But if I had to guess, and if it's true that sex is performance, I would say that probably what you would find is that at home, Jessica Alba is far more interested in simply being the real woman that she is, as opposed to putting on a performance. And the same holds true for Beyonce. And the same probably holds true in general, on average, for most women. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.